We have this morning this fairly simple truth, in a sense, which I'm sure all of us are aware of: life is not fair. But as we start, and even as we think that about life being unfair, one of the things that we should understand as Christians is that God is for us. God has entered in to the unfairness of human existence through Jesus Christ our Lord. And this makes a difference. So I just want to hold that out in front of you, and for you to keep that in your minds, even as we think about things that are unfair, so that you don't feel overwhelmed by the unfairness, by the suffering, but know that God is there with you. In the Bible, we read the story of Job. But imagine for one moment it was your life story being written for future generations to read. Would your story more likely be written as an encouragement that people could follow in their way of life? Or would your life be written as a warning? Don't follow this example. I hope my story, while being a mixture of both, would lean more towards being able to encourage people. And so I wonder, what is the story you are living? What is happening on the page for you in this week? And if, as the Bible says, we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, what is it they are watching as our lives unfold? So we're looking into the book of Job, and this is a difficult book for us to read and to understand. I want to give some little context to suffering, to evil, to why life is unfair, before we move on to what's being said in Job. I'm just going to skim over this. So in Genesis, we read that God made all things good. He saw what he had made, and it was very good. So the problem of life being less than good, the problem of suffering, of evil, of things being unfair, are not part of what God had originally desired for us, his people. The problem arose when Adam and Eve disobeyed God, eating from the tree of good and evil, so that they had the breadth of knowledge. Up to that point, they had only known the goodness of God in creation, but from then on, they also had tasted evil and would continue to experience that in their lives. What happened to them was they fell. They disobeyed God, and death came into our world. Death stretches out its tentacles not only in the moment of physical death, but in the sickness that leads to death, in the heartache that we sometimes have. And so for Adam and Eve, this was seeing their son Cain take the wrong path, the evil path, and choose to murder his brother. And so they were bereft. They lost their son Abel. And there was the heartache and pain, the unfairness of that situation. Also in this, we find the imbalances in creation, which had been created very good, but now became subject to death. Meaning that Adam and Eve, in those since, have had to deal with the harshness of the natural world that is around us. From the little things of weeds that grow in our garden, the strenuous work that we need to undertake, to the brokenness of creation and of our societies. And death is keenly felt in the breakdown of relationships. The relationship between Adam and Eve and God was broken. The relationship between Adam and Eve themselves was damaged when they had to cover themselves up and hide their nakedness from each other. And it came to them as spiritual death. To us, that leaves us bereft in life, lacking and lost, and knowing there's something more, but without Christ, unable to find it. The New Testament refers to death as our enemy, and our enemy death is at the heart of all that is unfair. We feel the effects of death when a relationship breaks down, when something is stolen from us, when we are betrayed, when illness strikes, when hope is lost, when hearts are broken. We feel the tentacles of death by the hospital bedside and by the graveside. And this is the unfairness that enters into Job's life. Loss of wealth, tragically loss of family, and then loss of his health. And it's important for us to realize that when God made creation, he made things good for our welfare so we could enjoy the paradise of the Garden of Eden. The unfairness of life has not come to us because God is unfair, but because we fell into sin. And the death and the evil from that day on has blistered up, bubbled up, erupting in suffering in each of our lives in a variety of ways. God's plan in Jesus Christ is to rescue humanity, to restore our relationship with him and with others, to wipe the tears from our eyes, to prepare us for an eternity in his presence, and to have us in his presence through eternity. And we just need to keep those things in mind as we think about suffering. So last week, we looked at the courtroom scene, how in heaven Satan had come and God and Satan had this conversation and Satan began to inflict suffering on Job. And today we're stepping away from that slightly just to look at who Job himself was so that we can understand how unfair all of this really is. So the scholar Christopher Ashe notes there are four things we're told about Job: his integrity, his treatment of others, his religion, his morality. First of all, we're told that Job was blameless. This means that he was a man of integrity. Saying that he is blameless is not the same as saying he is sinless. Job himself recognizes that he has sinned. And so later on he wrote, speaking to God, surely then you will count my steps but not keep track of my sin. Some of you might be wearing a watch that keeps track of your steps. God's been doing this for a long, long time, keeping track of your steps. It would be terrible if on that same watch it also kept track of your sins. Surely, Job says, you will keep count of my steps but not keep track of my sin. My offenses will be sealed up in a bag. You will cover my sin. So he knows he has sinned. The blamelessness here points to his integrity, his intention, his aim, his heart's desire. He never intends to hurt people or to harm them or to take advantage of them. His integrity would lead him to do what is right. He had standing in the community, not simply because he was wealthy. Of course, wealth attracts people's attention, but he had standing in his community because of the type of person he was. He could be trusted. And also, we're told Job was upright. This relates to his treatment of others. While being blameless refers to his inner character, being upright refers to how he lived and what he did. One commentator points to an old Jewish adage that says, and referring to Job, his within was like his without. His within was like his without. There was nothing hypocritical about Job. In a sense, what you see is what you get. His actions were consistently straight, true, with integrity. He also feared God. And this speaks of his religion. To be God-fearing is to have a reverence and awe of God. It's not in the sense of being frightened or scared as if God were a menace to avoid. To be God-fearing is to have an understanding of God, to be aware of God's presence, that we would worship him, take him into account in the decisions that we make, seek his ways in our prayers. Now, we are given some information about Job's religion, but it's not detailed. He was not an Israelite. He was not of the family of Abraham. He stands outside that Abrahamic tradition, perhaps something akin to Melchizedek, who some of you will think about in the Old Testament, was a priest of God, but not in the family of Israel. And while Job does make sacrifices for his children, he's not doing it in the way formulated by Moses, whereby Aaron and the priests would do this sacrificing. This is different for Job. He prayed to God, he worshipped God, but we don't know too much about how his religion unfolded. Not a lot of detail. But, as one scholar says, Job was, in the very best sense of the word, a genuinely religious man. In the best sense of the word, a genuinely religious man. And Job shunned evil. He lived by this moral code. He wouldn't entertain evil thoughts. He wouldn't involve himself in evil actions. He avoided evil. He shunned it. He kept far away from it so as not to be entangled in it. Undoubtedly, as a rich man, as a successful man, many people came to him with wonderful deals and ideas and get-rich-quick schemes. But Job's spiritual character was such, he would put a space between himself and anything that he considered might be wrong. He was so sensitive to this and so desirous of maintaining a good relationship with God that he offered sacrifices on behalf of his children just in case, maybe on the off chance that they had sinned. And there's a very real sense in which we would do well to follow Job's example, to be blameless, upright, God-fearing, shunning evil. Those things alone can shape and change lives. When we look at Job's children, they seem to be having a wonderful, wonderful life. For them, it was party time almost every month. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And every month they held a big party, and the sons would invite the daughters to come along. There's no indication of excessive drinking, rowdiness, or bad behavior at their parties. They are not described to us like the prodigal son who shamed his father and wasted his inheritance. It just seems that this was a family in good spirit who really enjoyed each other's company, who kept finding reasons, let's get together and have a party and have a feast. And just in case anything untoward had happened, as I mentioned a moment ago, Job would then make a sacrifice, a burnt offering for each of them. There were 10 of them. That's 10 burnt offerings. This is another indication of Job's wealth, that every month he could bring 10 burnt offerings for his children. This would have cost a small fortune. It also reveals the strength of his convictions. This was his regular custom, not just something he did every now and then, but every time they had one of these celebrations. So Job was doing his best to help his children maintain a right relationship with God. And I think that that can fairly be said of godly parents who want to see the same thing for their children, that we do our best to help our children maintain a right relationship with God. Then to understand Job a little more, we are given a sense of his business ventures. So he owned 7,000 sheep. Now, when we think of shepherds in Jesus' day, we normally think of them of having a handful, 10 or 12, 20 sheep maybe, and they take the sheep in and out to the pastures. But Job owned 7,000. He had flocks of sheep all around the place. This was his, in a sense, livestock business, and that would have produced wool and fleece and meat animals for the market, animals for sacrifice. He also owned 3,000 camels. Think of those as little trucks. He was in this sort of haulage business, or perhaps providing beasts of burden for others who needed them. And so he had 3,000 camels. And camels, we know, were used in caravans transporting goods. He had 500 yoke of oxen and 500 donkeys. This is his agricultural business. The oxen yoked together would plough the fields. And so you can imagine with that number of oxen, there would be a lot of fields being ploughed and seed being sown. And the donkeys, of course, were beasts of burden that would, I suppose they're a bit like a four-wheel motorbike on the farm. They'd be carrying lots of things around. Added to this, Job had a large number of servants. Not slaves, servants. People that he employed, people that were in a relationship with his family to do this work. And so you understand it's not only Job who was benefiting, it's the local community who are benefiting from his wealth and all the jobs that he created. The author underlines Job's character and standing by saying he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. Job was not only on the rich list, he was at the top of the rich list. And his greatness is not only in regard to his wealth, but also in regard to his character. He was a great man, a great person. One commentator sums this up, writing, "Everything about Job is ideal," which has the purpose of portraying him as the ultimate example of a person who is beyond reproach, who has achieved success by the highest standards. Now, I'm fairly confident that no one in Job's day would begrudge Job his wealth, because he was the kind of person you respected. You knew that he had earned this honestly. He hadn't gained his wealth by trickery, by shady deals, by bribing officials. Job was a person of the highest personal and professional standards. And the casual observer of Job would surmise Job has been blessed by God for his righteousness, and his prosperity is proof of what a good man he is. No one looking at Job could imagine that everything would be stripped of him so quickly, so that even his closest friends would suggest, "Job, we thought, you know, you were blameless, a person of integrity, shunning evil, fearing God, but we think all that was just a facade. You must have been really bad, really, really bad inside, for all these bad things to have happened to you. But we know Job has done nothing to deserve what is about to befall him. He's exemplary in all aspects of his life. And this is what makes the extent of his fall, of his suffering, seem so unfair." So now we think about the unfairness of these things. Life is unfair. We know that. Job later wrote about this. "Why do the wicked live on? The wicked growing old and increasing in power. They see their children established around them. Their offspring are before their eyes. Their homes are safe. They are free from fear. The rod of God is not on them. Yet they say to God, 'Leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him?'" And this, in a sense, is a picture of wicked people rejecting God, and yet their lives are comfortable. They're doing well. Now, we know the wicked don't always prosper, but it happens often enough to come to our attention and to cause us to question the fairness of life. Perhaps you know someone, or you yourself have been cheated by some others, by someone who's cut some corners, taken advantage of you, and done well out of it. If life was fair, they wouldn't get away with that. But so often they seem to. And while you're busy doing what's right at cost to yourself, you're disadvantaged by that, in a sense, to do what's right. They seem to be just going on ahead in leaps and bounds. And you don't need to try very hard to find examples of this. You may have read in the news this week that many pensioners who have undertaken some extra employment to get a little bit of money in, but they've inadvertently been on the wrong tax code, have received tax bills for thousands of dollars. These are pensioners trying to sort of earn a little bit more, make life a little bit better, and now they've got this big bill from the tax department. I listened recently to a podcast which explained how Jeff Bezos, who is the second richest man in the world, who has a net worth of 186, 187, 188, 190, it just keeps going up all the time, billions of dollars. This is what is happening for him, yet he pays less tax than most of us. I was interested to find out how he did that. So his payment for being CEO of Amazon is a mere $80,000 a year. The poor guy. He's not on much. So if he wants a new car or a new house or a new yacht, he can't afford it on his salary. So he borrows money from the bank. And banks are happy to lend it to him because while his salary is modest, his wealth is immense. So technically, he has a high personal debt. And thus, under the special laws in the USA, he doesn't have to pay much tax, if any. He isn't breaking any laws. But it does seem unfair that someone who could afford to pay tax pays so little, while some pensioners who do a little bit of work on the side end up getting a tax bill from the IRD. Life is not fair. More sadly, I've told you before of a friend whose little boy ran out on the road to get a ball and died when struck by a car. Or the parishioner who was hunting with his teenage son when a faulty rifle misfired and the young boy died. Or I might have told you of my elderly aunt who was selling her home and was duped by a real estate agent who was later taken to a tribunal. You will have examples of your own, perhaps among your family or your friends, tragedy or difficulties that seem unfair. We see this in the news all the time. An elderly person conned out of their life savings. A couple who scrimp and save for their first home only to find that it hasn't been built properly. There's some damage to it hidden away. Or the recent storm that struck our city in one of the poorer suburbs, where people could hardly afford insurance and many have lost what little they had. Or the collapse of an apartment building in Florida while people slept. Life is unfair, fickle, unpredictable. We can't assume that those who are suffering have done something to provoke the wrath of God. And indeed, what we are learning about Job's blameless life underlines this. So what's going on here? What's going on with this unfairness? Clearly, Job is not someone just picked at random. Remember, we're saying this is a wisdom book rather than a history book. And in this story, Job is not your average guy. Job is the most godly man on earth. Job is God's prime example of what a godly man is like. And this is important for us to, as we read the book and try to understand it. If the godliest person can be caused to curse God, then what about everyone else? If Job fails, then all, in a sense, are vulnerable. Now, suppose Job had a brother. Let's call him Bob. Suppose instead of Job, the most godly man on earth, the focus of this book had been on his brother Bob, a lackadaisical, half-hearted follower of God, who had a little bit of integrity, but really only when others were watching. And sometimes Bob feared God, but other times he was pretty certain God was far too busy to be paying attention to his life. Generally, Bob shunned evil, but occasionally he found it paid. Now, if a man like Bob suddenly lost everything, that wouldn't surprise us. You know, people would expect judgment on such a person. If Bob was tested, it probably wouldn't be long before he cursed God. If a half-hearted person was to fail, it wouldn't really mean that much to humanity, because such people fail all the time. But if the best fails, then all fail. And this is important to the story and to God's glory. God's plan through Abraham is to develop a family of faith and would bring people from all nations into a relationship with God. But if human worship of God is only there because God is doling out blessings to those who will worship him, then God's policies are flawed. If we were looking at the book of Bob, God had chosen to allow Satan to test him, someone who had nothing, was no one, perhaps was already dying of a sickness, such a person would have nothing to lose. But given Job is healthy, spiritually strong, wealthy, with a large, happy family, with a high status, he has so much to lose. His extreme suffering makes this a real test. And from Satan's perspective, if Job is simply propped up by God's blessing, if there's nothing more substantial to his relationship with God, if Job will fall and fail, then God's plans will be in tatters. God's glory will be diminished. Satan will have found this flaw and struck a serious blow to God's plans. This is also the tactic that Satan used on Jesus, the Son of God, the truly perfect human, as he began his ministry. Satan tried to turn Jesus away from God and to make Jesus fall into sin. So Satan tempted Jesus. Oh, if you're hungry, you're God's son, turn the stones into bread. That would be fine. If you're God's son, prove it by jumping from a high tower. Let's see if he'll save you. If you want the world, I'll give it to you. All you have to do is to worship me. Now, we said Job was blameless, but we know Jesus was sinless. If Jesus fell into sin, God's plan would have failed, God's glory stained. Job was tempted to curse God and die. In a strange twist, Jesus took this curse on himself. He was the one who became cursed in our place. In Deuteronomy, we read, if a man guilty of capital offenses put to death and his body is hung on a tree, you must not leave his body on the tree overnight. Be sure to bury him that same day, because anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. To be executed on a cross, a tree of sorts, was proof that Jesus was cursed by God. Job is a type, is a character who in part will help us to understand Jesus, the suffering servant, who, while being in the nature of God, Jesus, would leave the riches, leave all that he had in heaven to be born as one of us, setting aside his glory, in humility giving it all up for us, entering into our suffering, suffering for us on the cross, and yet remaining without sin. In the Old Testament, Job would reach a point where, although it wasn't true, he thought God had abandoned him. In the New Testament, Jesus reached a point where God truly did abandon him. And Jesus cried out in faith, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, what difference does this make to us? The world we live in is broken. Things have been unfair to me and will be unfair to you. And you may have suffered in a variety of ways in your life. The Apostle Paul, speaking of creation, says it's subject to frustration. The whole creation is groaning and waiting to be liberated from its bondage to decay. Storms and earthquakes and disease are all part of this fallen world. Sinful humanity inflicts harm upon others. Just think of that recent ransomware attack on the Waikato DHB. Some people who were due for urgent surgery because their lives were at risk had it delayed because of criminal activity. And imagine not just the stress of those who were looking for major treatment that had to be rescheduled or moved to another city, but even to those looking for relatively minor treatment that would improve the quality of their lives. drunk drivers, con men, through to bad government policy and war. We humans inflict great harm on each other. Those people who did the ransomware couldn't care less about the health of those who were suffering. And added to all of this, we have a spiritual enemy, the devil, who seeks to harm us. And because of all this, life is unfair. We're caught up in it. The innocent suffer. Well, there is a mystery to the book of Job we cannot fully grasp or easily explain. This story is taking us on a journey to understand something more about suffering and about God. It does so first by telling us about Job, stressing his good character, his success in life, the man who had everything and thus everything to lose. And still we're just in Job in chapter 1, setting the scene. This is uncomfortable reading as we struggle to make sense of it. At the end of the book, it will lead us to God, to the relationship that he offers. More fully, the answer is to see that God has ended our suffering in Jesus Christ, so we can find his comfort and his peace. Life is unfair. You will find it is unfair. But in this, God will be with you every step of the way. So, let us hold God's hand and receive his comfort and his strength today and in the days that lie ahead. We're going to sing a song.